Abstract Athlete Podcast, where art and sports collide. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for listening to the Abstract Athlete Podcast. Swing by our website, theabstractathlete.com, and our social media platforms, and check out our product lines, news, and upcoming events. And remember to listen to the two other podcasts on the Abstract Athlete Network, the Abstract Doctors Podcast and the Abstract Veterans Podcast. Really excited about the podcast today as I get to speak with photographer, director, and CEO of the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts and avid sports fan, Alex Nurgis. Make sure to follow Alex on Instagram at ALNYERGES and stop by his website, alexnurgis.com. Let's welcome Alex Nurgis.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I am doing awesome. I'm a little tired. We just did some events out at the Super Bowl, so.
Oh, wow. Fun.
Didn't get to go to the game, but, you know, which would have been super cool, but eventually, you know, we'll be able to do that, hopefully. So, but thank you for doing this. Like, I've been actually really super looking. I'm recording, by the way.
Good.
Been super excited about doing this because I think it'll be truly interesting for anyone who listened to this, but actually, especially for people that are where we both live in Richmond, Virginia, to know some stuff about you that maybe they don't know.
And all right.
And I, you know, like doing some research, you know, one of the things, first of all, you know, you've been the director of the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts since 2006. You had other museum jobs. You're also a fantastic photographer. But one of the things that I found super interesting was that you actually have a degree in anthropology and archaeology. And one of the things I'm interested in that is, does that play into your photography, which I like when I look at your photography at first, or, you know, seeing your work for a long time, you know, I think about landscapes, like more urban landscapes or just about place really. Mm-hmm. And like, so I think does the archaeology play into, first of all, I'm like fascinated by archaeology. So it's like a personal thing, but does that play into your photography at all?
Well, it's, you know, it's a great question, and I've never thought about it that way. I think archaeology plays into a lot of things, for certain. I mean, first of all, I started doing field school when I was, I want to say, 13 or 14 years old. Took courses in archaeology, learned lab work, learned that. And when I was 16, I received an award from the U.S. Department of Education to go on an archaeological dig in St. Mary City, Maryland.
Wow.
That was the summer of 1973. And that was only the second year they were down in St. Mary's, which was the original colonial capital of Maryland. And so the chief archaeologist, I remember his name, Gary Wheeler Stone, and a whole bunch of others. And then there were students, as well as the professional archaeologist, graduate students. And then I was kind of a lone ranger of sorts, because I was the odd person in the group having come on an expedition grant. And of course, didn't go any further than Maryland. But I spent the summer there and determined that clearly I was going to go to college for archaeology. Went to George Washington. First 2 years there, I interned at the Smithsonian in a couple of different, three or four different departments. And gain more work with material and all of that, and inside the museum. And then in the summer of 1977, I got my first paying job in the museum field, which was as a junior archaeologist in the Department of North American Archaeology at the Smithsonian. And I went out west in early May to a place called Vernon, Colorado. Actually,
oh yeah,
I that know was where that the is. closest town to where I was, but it was basically where Kansas, Nebraska, and Colorado meet yep. in the eastern part of the state. Lived out there for the summer. We were paid the grand total of $400 a month plus room and board. And it was great, three meals a day. Although the accommodations were suspect. There were 40 of us on the dig. And I lived with two others in an Airstream trailer up on blocks that had no electricity, no running water. And I shared the front room of this Airstream with another junior archaeologist guy, Gary. And this comes back to photography. The real prize was that the bedroom in the back of the trailer, which was a nice private space, mind you, all of it was hotter than hell out there.
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, it warmed up like an oven. So, but that was the archaeological crew's photographer. He had the easiest job. We're sitting down in the pits, digging and sweating and dealing with snakes and, you know, all kinds of scorpions. And what's this guy doing? Setting up his camera, putting the camera on a huge tripod over the grids and taking pictures. And then, you know, kind of taking it easy until they needed another photograph.
Yep.
It's like, okay. And I thought, well, clearly. And I tell you what, Ron, I discovered three things. I hate dirt. I wanted to have an inside museum job, not an outside museum job. And I actually hated archaeology because I realized it was about science. It's about science and statistics and stuff that I have no interest in whatsoever.
Right.
What I know about science, you could put in a thimble and it wouldn't fill it. And so I thought, go back to Washington, go back to school and get a degree. And I switched over and added American civilization to my degree and studied history, art history, all kinds of things of that nature. And then went to graduate school for museum work.
Okay. And how did that photographer, like, was that like a start of like, I'm interested in photography from that moment?
Oh no, I borrowed my brother Paul's Olympus OM-2 camera, 35mm camera. Yep. So this is 1977. He had gotten it the previous year. I didn't have a really good camera, and that was one of the better 35mm at the time. And so I took it, and in my spare time, that's all I did was shoot. But I started taking pictures when I was a kid. I mean, I grew up in Rochester, New York, and you leave the hospital with a camera right. as a newborn. So, you know.
That's actually a good idea. I actually like that. They should just start giving kids cameras when they leave the hospital.
Yeah. I mean, it's and of course, today, everybody has a phone instead of a camera. But, you know, it's deeply ingrained. Two of my brothers, my youngest brother, who's out near San Diego, is a photographer, and my older brother, who spent a career as a library director, has always dabbled in photography. And when he retired about 5 years ago, all he's done is photography.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, so he's deep into it, you know, works every day at his art, and I do too. I mean, I'm sitting here in my studio office at home, which is where I retreat to every day, yep. sometimes for a very little period of time, or like on Sunday before the Super Bowl, I was in here for about 6 hours, fairly nonstop, only getting up to go over to the kitchen to get another glass of water and come back. And I was doing a bunch of test prints because I work on A4 paper and print test prints until I get it right, or I drop it all together and stop messing with that negative.
Were your parents interested in photography? Because I think that's really cool that, like, your both your siblings are so interested in? I mean, was it part of like your growing up?
It's in the DNA, and okay. it's in the Hungarian side of the family, not at all on my Italian side. My mother was Italian. My father came from Hungary, and one of the few things that he brought to this country was a camera, 35 millimeter camera. In fact, I've got it sitting on a shelf.
Wow.
And he loved photography. His sister and brother-in-law, who are also from Hungary, the only Hungarian relatives we had in this country, they were scientists and worked for Eastman Kodak Company.
Wow.
And you know, my uncle Tibor had a dark room in the basement. So my dad would be down there from time to time, but he was always taking pictures.
Yeah.
And then the other influence, though, in growing up in Rochester, beyond just the obvious of Kodak, is the George Eastman Museum.
Yep.
And which was then known as the George Eastman House, International Museum of Photography and then Film. And I would go up there in the summer times. I'd pedal my bike. It was a mile and a half. Pedal my bike up the hill, and I'd be there. They would do programs on in the summer at 1 o'clock in the Dryden Theater, films. And there was a curator of film, a guy named James Card. So I'm, you know, 14 years old. You know, I love photography, but I actually had this notion, I want to be a film historian.
Yeah.
And so that morphed obviously into photo history and the like. But the Hungarian side, the exhibition that we will open at the Virginia Museum in October, but it's opening at the Museum of Fine Arts, the National Gallery in Budapest in April, is all about photographers born in Hungary in the 20th century that come to America and become American photographers. So it's an unbelievable number of great photographers. So it's got to be, it's in the DNA, it's in the blood.
Yep.
And we can't help ourselves. Now, one of my brothers, Ron, is not a photographer.
Okay.
And
how dare him?
Well, but he makes up for it because he's a jazz musician.
Okay.
He's been a professional jazz person for 40 some years. Plays endless gigs, does lots of recordings, played with lots of big names along the way. He's a keyboard artist as well as a composer. So we give him a pass. But I don't even know if the boy owns a camera, to be honest.
Well, we'll get now. I have like jazz. My grandfather was a jazz musician. Unfortunately, he passed like when I was like 8 or something. But he, same thing. Like he played with like Glenn Miller and different stuff. So I have music in my blood as well. And it's so cool. Like the stories you're telling are just so cool in terms of like a trajectory of your kind of life and how like this. There's a, like you said, it's in the blood. It's like there's this history to it. And then I want to go to the one of the cool things again, like I don't think most people would know about. You told me that your one of your dreams was to be the shortstop for the Baltimore Orioles. And I, which I absolutely love, because that's, you know, what our platform, The Abstract Athlete, a lot of it, what we talk about is this relationship between art and sports, how connected they are. Mm-hmm. Like both of them are so good for mental health and wellness and, but just literally like, you know, I was a baseball player. I think we like had chatted right. a little bit about that, right. But for me, it's like, it's one of those things where I think, and I say this a lot on the podcast, we are defined by what people see, you know, mm-hmm. or who we are. Like when I was growing up, I was an athlete. Nobody knew I was creative. Like for you, you're probably, everybody knows you as the director of the museum. Like probably some people don't even know you're a photographer, but to know this, like, I think it just adds all these layers about the, and the archaeology thing for me, like finding that it's like, it adds these layers that I start, it makes your work to me more fascinating as, you know, like when I look at your photographs, because I start thinking about all these other things. And so, long way to get to a question, but you have this, obviously this interest in sports too. Did you have an athletic family or interest in, like, how did that come about? Like, what was the impetus of, and was it, was it a Cal Ripken thing? You know, what was the Baltimore Oriole fascination? And do you still watch sports? Like, obviously you watch the Super Bowl, like we talked about, but
yeah. All the time. Oh, I mean, I live and breathe baseball. I mean, I like football, and, you know, basketball and football are great too, but I mean, baseball, you know, and not to be sacrilegious, but I'll just provide a little known quote from the Bible.
Yeah.
And it's Genesis 1:1. And in every book I've ever seen, it's a misprint. Because what it says there is in the beginning, except that it's a misprint. What they really meant it to be is in the big inning. And that's when God created heaven and earth. And so, I mean, God's a baseball fan, just as we are. But no, my time about dreaming about baseball was long before Cal Ripken. In fact, he went to my high school a handful of years after I was there. But I actually, as much as I had the dream of baseball, I had a dream about golf. And I captained my high school golf team, which I can only tell you was what kept me from playing baseball. When I went to college, I actually walked on to the team at George Washington, which was Division I, aided by the fact that I think they were like 2-27 the year before. And the coach was looking for any warm body. And so I showed up. I showed up 7 mornings a week, the days for infielders. And I got stuck at second base only because I'm small. And Division I, our starting second baseman was a second team All-American. Wow. And he was like 6'2 and, you know, 190. And here I am coming in at 5'4 with my shoes on. Like, no, you're not going to play the outfield. Although I did play one spring training game. It was the spring of 76. And it's only because our prize outfielder, the coach didn't want to risk him. Yep. We were our home field at the time was the ellipse behind the White House. And it was icing and the ground was covered with ice. And he's like, Alex, you're playing right field. Even with cleats on, it was like being on an ice rink.
Yep.
I protected our star right fielder just to get some playing time in. But I, you know, here's the thing. If you look at all of the skills that one needs to make it in baseball, and particularly make it to the major leagues, all I lacked was speed, power, a throwing arm, and a batting average. Other than that, I could have been in the Hall of Fame by now.
You're a one-star athlete. Like, yeah. That's great. I love that. It's interesting to me though, too, because like, we're going to probably talk forever now about baseball, like beyond this podcast, but like I actually, in some of my artist statements, mention baseball, like how it influences how I think. And, mm-hmm. and I my paintings are kind of based on my experiences of going out west and looking at the landscape. But for me, and I'm going to bring this archaeology term back to you, it's like baseball is archaeology. Like the innings are the buildup, and like, and you know, it's like it's a historical thing per any, like, which is kind of how I relate to when I go out west and you feel like you can see forever, you know, that it's like a visual archaeology. So I've always kind of, you know, put that in, like, people wouldn't go up to my work and go, oh yeah, I see baseball, and that's not the intent, but it's like that thinking. And it's like, I love hearing, like, again, like this relationship for you of your, like, because again, like, I think your life is just so fascinating to me. And I think, again, I think when people hear this, it'll open up to like different things to like, and how maybe mm-hmm. you think as a curator or like, I think sports is so important in terms of like, first of all, work ethic, which, you know, unfortunately, right. artists always get kind of, you know, shit on because we don't work hard enough. Well, most do. But it's like that idea of discipline. But it's also like, I think of you as a director and thinking of, you know, like you're probably like a coach in a lot of ways, and how you, you know, maybe you see different things and how they're put together, like a game plan of sorts. Have you ever thought about it in those terms?
Well, one of the ways, and thought about it yesterday and this morning, is about being a baseball manager. And the analogy was the one that played in my mind, because as the director of a large institution, we have 700 employees, I often think about, particularly with my senior management team, I think about being the manager.
Yep.
And I've got 9 position players.
Yep.
And I've got to think about, okay, do I have the right person at shortstop? You know, can I move the shortstop over to second base? And there are things that, in fact, we're looking at some organizational structure questions that I've got to talk to some folks about today at a lunch meeting. And it is about the same way that Earl Weaver used to think about, you know, the Orioles when he managed them in the 60s and 70s. Yep. So that is always on the top of my mind. And, you know, the good news with baseball, and you just touched on it, and Cal Ripken, you mentioned, Cal Ripken was a good player, but he made himself into a Hall of Fame great player. Yep. Because of discipline, as you mentioned, and constantly working at it. And I know you do this because I do this. You know, Sunday, I was in here for 6 hours. I did 19 prints, and some of them were repeat prints with just a few changes. But you have to work at it to perfect it. And people look at a photograph of mine, it's like, oh, that's beautiful.
Yep.
And then, you know, and I do everything digital on Lightroom on this machine. And I mean, I've done as many as 300 or more steps. Yep. In a single photograph to get it right. Because then translating into a print on paper, and then also, you know, thinking, well, will this work from 8x10 into 24x36. And it's the same as like knowing where the ball's gonna bounce and how you position your feet, and you ready yourself in a position as a shortstop. That's the same thing that we do as artists, because when you put the brush onto the canvas, it's like, okay, you know how that should happen.
Yep.
And react. Now, it doesn't always work out that way. I mean, in baseball, it hits a stone, you know. Yep. Bounces up and hits you in the throat, and you know, you get laid out. That's the fun of it. But you know, I went to college and chose my college choices where to apply to, including George Washington, on the basis that they had archaeology, but they also had journalism. Particularly was what I was interested in was sports journalism and photojournalism. And although I've never really done sports photography, I do get lens envy every time I go to a ball game. It's like, oh my God, yeah, 1200 millimeter lens, you know, this big. It's like, oh Lord.
I'll have to connect you with a friend of mine that's become a friend of mine that has been the head photographer for the NBA / the Lakers for the last 40 years, and just the nicest guy. And I'm like, I get that jealousy factor too, because it's like he, you know, he's captured some of these, like the most quintessential moments in history. He took like the photo of LeBron James scoring, you know, the points to break Jabbar's record. And the cool thing to me about that photo is if you look at it, he's shooting like from his back. And all you see in the crowd is every single person is holding their phone up, including his two boys, except for Phil Knight, who owns Nike. And I think it's such a photograph that really speaks to the time we're in. Like you mentioned, we all have cameras, but are they experiencing the moment or are they capturing the moment? Like, and I think that that's a really interesting dynamic, because like, as you know, as a photographer, like, I think for you, like you are capturing moments because you've been doing it for a long time. But like for people now with phones, I think some people are actually missing the moment with, I mean, do you ever think about like how your photographs resonate with people? Like, cause I do, like for me, like when I look at your photographs, they're very much about place. A very, you know, like, I don't know, do you consider yourself a landscape photographer? Like in that sense, would you call yourself that or just?
No, in fact, I'll tell you a funny quick story. Yeah. I was out at the University of Richmond a handful of years ago, and one of the professors of art was in the lobby with a bunch of his students, photography students, and I was going to a lecture out there. And he stopped me and he said, "Oh, Alex, I'd like you to meet my students." And so I said, "Great," all these budding young photographers. And he introduced me as a landscape photographer.
Yeah.
And I bristled. Now, if you look at my photography, in fact, I'd have to look around the room at all the prints laying around here. Lots of them are landscape photographs.
Yep.
But you touched on it a moment ago. It's the sense of place.
Yep.
And yes, it might be a landscape, although I tend not to do much on the pure landscape side. I like the built environment more than I like, you know, in fact, one of my favorite pictures was a photograph in Colorado in 1977 on that archaeological dig with that Olympus camera. And it's a cornfield with the outhouse and then the sunset creating bands of light and color around and above the outhouse. And it's not, I guess you could call it a landscape. I mean, it's a portrait of an outhouse that I used, you know, every day I was out that summer. But it's a sense of place. And yep. So that speaks to my singular memory of that time there, because the rest of the time there, I mean, it was not fun. The chief archaeologist was crazy. He was mean. Oh no, I mean, we're talking, he was evil and racist. It was terrible.
Geez.
Yeah. And you know, there were about six or seven of us that were in our 20s, young, you know, new archaeologist. And I'll just say this because it's the truth and off color as it is. He threatened us more than a few times. He said, "I should fire all of you and replace you with wetbacks.
Oh my God.
I can pay them $1 a day and they'd be happy." And it's like, I'm sorry. And, you know, it just got to the point that, you know, we were about to have a revolt and walk off the job. But it was terrible. And that kind of business permeates actually archaeology. The highest incidence of alcoholism of, I think, any profession out there. I mean, it's just, it wasn't for me, but it gave me the opportunity to say, I got to go do something different.
Right.
But the one lasting memory that I have is a photograph, which one of these days I'm going to scan that negative and play with it a little bit.
I was looking on your site while you were talking to see if it was actually on here. I saw your show a couple years ago at Reynolds. I mean, I've seen other works, or, you know, I think I saw a show also years back at Glave Cosin. But the one at Reynolds, again, it was just so striking. And I actually remember talking, I can't remember who was working there, just about that, again, that sense it's almost like that transporting. And some of them, like, you know, like I don't always look at like tags to see where, like, but it's just like, I feel like I'm being transported to that place. Mm-hmm. And I think that becomes so powerful, as, you know, whether it's painting or photography or whatever, that like a piece can do that. The one thing I wanted to ask you actually about, like, you predominantly work in black and white, but then, you know, like, again, I just going through your site, you know, a couple days ago, last week, whatever, there are moments that color kind of splashes in. And is there, like, what's the point where you decide the yes and no of addition of color, or like allowing color to come through? Because it even in those, like, it's almost like monochrome. I don't want to say that, like, you know, broad brush speaking, but sweeping, not that, but there's always that, it's very subtle in how you allow the color. Is there reasons for like predominantly black and white, or like when color does become part of it?
Well, black and white for me starts when I was a kid. You know, I would take pictures and do mostly black and white. In fact, my Aunt Yolanda would give us 35 millimeter film that we could use, and they would process it for us, and we'd make prints. I mean, so I started, you know, in high school, all we did was black and white in the lab. I never learned to develop or print color. So out of habit, black and white was my go-to choice. When I graduated from using 35 millimeter to 4x5, I, you know, used black and white film, you know, developed and processed that, printed that. And, you know, over the years, I think in black and white. So if I see something, like right now, just looking at the screen with this big disc and the light coming off of it and the arc and the other arc, I mean, there's a photograph there that's essentially something in design, but what I see isn't the color. I see black and white.
Right.
Now, to your question, when I go from black and white to color, it's primarily because I'll take the color out of the negative, out of the image, and what I'm left with, I don't like. And so where, you know, there's a photograph I did down on Route 301 in the middle part of Florida above Ocala. And it was it's a falling down motel called the Orange Blossom Motel. And so I did that in black and white, a test print, tried to print it larger, and it died. The sign, which says Orange Blossom Motel, was orange with black lettering. And I thought, okay, well, maybe I just need to add that as color. And I could not believe how successful that was. And it really then evoked what I thought of, and going back to your phrase, sense of place, that sense of place was solidified, where in black and white, it just didn't work. And so it's a rare moment when color wins out over black and white, because I dream in shades of gray. And quite honestly, when people ask me sometimes, you know, particularly photographers, is like, what do you take pictures of? Going back to your question about landscape photography.
Yeah.
I take pictures of light.
Yeah.
And the element that's necessary with light for me is shadow.
Yep.
And so I'm drawn to shadow. And part of it is my study of art history, and particularly photo history, and particularly with Hungarian American photographers. And modernism, all of the photographers like Edward Weston and others starting in the 20s and 30s. I mean, for them, it was all about that intersection between light and shadow and then design. And I mean design in the sense of, what does the image look like?
Yep.
And how does it translate into something that becomes static at 8x10 or, you know, 13x19 or 24x36? And so that, to me, that's important. But occasionally, you know, I don't know that I've ever looked at something and said, ah, that's a work for color.
Right.
And it became a color image. Because if I've ever had that thought, I don't know that it's ever worked out. I mean, it's just, I think in black and white.
The Abstract Athlete Get Stacked Paint and Puzzle Kit, creative exercise designed in collaboration with former Ohio State Buckeye and NFL player Percy King. Create art as exercise for the mind. Order one of our art kits today, available at theabstractathlete.com, beginagaintoys.com, or on Amazon. The Abstract Athlete, where art and sport collide. Are you fully in digital now? You don't do any more 35, or do you still do both?
21 years of digital. Okay. And prior to doing that, I thought digital was not photography. I thought it was black magic.
Right.
I didn't understand it, but my wife, Catherine, had a business importing Chinese antique furniture. And she bought, and this is in the 90s, she bought a digital camera. It was boxy, 3.2 megapixels. She still has it. Obviously hasn't used it in 25 years, but she asked me, I was with her. She was in Beijing visiting a business partner of hers and buying furniture. And she said, would you mind taking pictures of the inventory I'm buying? And is like, oh, this is fun. So I did that, pretty rote. Anyways, when she was doing other things, I went out and it was this large complex owned by a woman named Tang Li. And she had about 40 or 50 people that worked for her. She had apartments where they lived and then workspace where the furniture was coming in from out in the hinterlands. And I started just taking pictures and, you know, I didn't think much of it. I took some pictures of people working, people sitting and having food. And then I went back, and we lived in Ohio, took it to the local camera shop, gave them the disc, and I said, just print me some 8x10s. Well, I went back a week later and they gave me the prints, and I was floored. I was stunned. I couldn't believe I had taken those pictures. I'm thinking, whoa, this is this. And I, at that point in time, I researched what was the best digital camera on the market that was more toward the pro side as opposed to, you know, something people would do for snapshots. And Canon had just come out with a 6-megapixel camera, the first of its kind, and you couldn't even get anywhere. And one of my board members at my former institution knew a fellow up in Chicago, a fellow billionaire, and they were able to grab me one from somewhere. And it was my first digital camera, and they were flying in from Chicago and then going to New York, and they stopped at an airfield outside of Dayton. I drove up there. They got off the plane. It was a private jet, handed me the box. I handed him a check, the fellow, his friend, a check for the camera. And then they got back on the plane and flew off. And I'm thinking, this feels very clandestine.
But that sounds like a scene from a movie.
Yeah, you couldn't get this camera anywhere. And so I became wed to Canon. And, you know, it's lightweight. I mean, I'd probably move into something like Mamiya or Hasselblad, you know, with a digital back kind of camera, but they're just so expensive and I'd have to get a whole new set of lenses. And quite frankly, I'm just happy with what I have. Yep. It works. Edward Weston made most of his great photographs with a $5 used lens. Yep. And you know, you can't fault his photographs.
No, it's interesting because I don't even know if we've talked about this at all. Like I mean, photography has always been kind of something that helps me with my paintings, but mm-hmm. I'll drive out west. I drive out west a lot. Like I mean, out there from here, drive out 3 times a year at least.
Wow.
And I've been taking landscape photographs for years and years. Not that I use them per se, like when I'm painting, but a lot of times I'll go back after I've made a painting and try to find a photograph that matches the painting, which makes no sense, but that's how I work. But in the last maybe 4 years, I've become absolutely addicted to wildlife photography because I go to Yellowstone all the time. And so it's one of those things where I've had Nikon my whole life and I've been getting new lenses and, you know, people like, oh, you should probably get a Sony. And I'm like, I kind of like Nikon. And like you said, it's like, if you switch over and I'm looking at getting a mirrorless camera. And if you do that, then you have to get, you know, an adapter to get to the different side, you know, and it's like, there's all these things and I'm like, I'm a painter, damn it. I got to spend money on paint. But so it's like an expensive hobby, but it's not a hobby. It's more than that to me. It's like, it's really part of my process. Because I think, you know, again, like I look at your photographs and they're very quiet. And I think they're moving, I guess is a way to say it. And I put that, like when I'm out there taking photographs, there was a moment this past summer that I was in Yellowstone and I was on the side of this little hill, mountain, whatever you want to call it. And I was watching a wolf, on a bison. And wow. I'm the only person that's seen this.
Yeah.
And so I go to that moment where, you know, there's 8 billion people on this planet and I'm I'm the lucky one that gets to see this. And I'm, you know, I take pictures, but I also like step back and just kind of take it in. And like when you're taking photographs, like, do you have those kind of, I don't know, moments of reflection, I guess is the best way to say it, where realize that you're in this presence of like the wow moment?
Every time I take a picture,
yeah, it's so great.
Inspired by emotion.
Yep.
And every time I take a picture, I know that I'm taking a photograph that if I don't capture that image, no one will ever see exactly that. The light, the framing, the perspective of where you are in terms of, you know, lateral and sideways and everything else. I mean, that can only be, and that's why, I mean, I spent a lot of time down on the river here in Richmond, and we live a stone's throw from the river. I mean, it's 2 minutes down to the water, and it's because I see things differently every time I walk through there. The emotion, if there's no emotion, I don't bother taking a picture. Yeah. But then it's translating the emotion that I've captured on my camera into being able to make it into a print, because unless I actually can print it, that emotion is like something locked up in a safe that nobody sees, nobody can experience. And so for me to be able to then translate it into a print that I can enlarge and people can enjoy, and what they enjoy is that emotion, and goes back to what you were talking about before, sense of place. And whether that sense of place is, you know, the Eiffel Tower or the James River. Yeah. And mind you, I work very hard to not create images that are, you know, syrupy sweet, not sentimental, but create, you know, a sense of place and capture that emotion in a way that, you know, nobody else is going to do exactly that way, because they're not standing there with those conditions at that very moment. And there are times when I've regretted, oh my God, I missed it by, you know, 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And I know it's gone and I walk away.
Yeah. So. That's hard. I mean, those are hard moments to like.
Well, I mean, you're seeing the bison and the wolf. I mean, my God, that kind of thing. If you don't shoot it, capture it, it's lost.
Yep.
Except your memory, and you know, nothing wrong with your memory or my memory, but you know, when we pass on, that memory disappears, and that's why your artwork, your photographs, my photographs, those theoretically will be around certainly longer than we are.
Yeah. We'll talk a little bit about your day job here. But I could talk to you all day about baseball and photography, but like, I come from Ohio, and we have like great museums up there. The Wexner Center is like such an incredible place. But I always tell people when I'm out and about, or when people come to town, that the VMFA, Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, is literally one of the best museums that I've been to. And like, you're such a huge part of that. And, you know, so I'll say thank you for that. But also, like, and this may be a weird question, like, do you have like a favorite exhibition that you've brought here that like maybe struck you? I know this is a stupid question, but like something that that really kind of just struck you in a different way, or was maybe more personal to you?
You know, Ron, the trouble is there are so many of them.
Yeah.
and you know, I just, you know, part of what we do at the Virginia Museum is bring the world of Virginia. And I'll just use one example, because I could talk for days about you know, Picasso and Chihuly and everything else, popular things, and then other things that are less popular. But I'll just use the exhibition we did a handful of years ago, an Emperor Qin and the Terracotta Army from Xi'an in China. And, you know, it is, and everybody I talk to about this, I encourage them, if you only go one place in life that's far away, go to Xi'an and stand on the edge of the pit number one because there are buried 8,000 plus of these soldiers and horses and carriages, many of which, two-thirds, three-quarters of which, are still buried. But it's the most spiritual experience one can have, because it's timeless. It's 20-some hundred years old, lost for two millennia until that farmer was digging in the field for a well. And it's unbelievable. Most people will never go to China. Certainly, most people will not go to Xi'an, because even if you go to China, Beijing is a two-hour flight from Xi'an. And you got to really make an effort to go there. And then, of course, it's a better part of an hour to drive from Xi'an out to the Museum of the Terracotta Army. So the vast majority of people will never get there. We were able to bring that collection that Li Jin, our curator of Chinese art, had put together, create a beautiful book, and have hundreds of thousands of people experience it in a way that, quite frankly, is almost better. I mean, first of all, you save yourself a couple of 12-hour plane rides, and then everything else that goes along with that kind of travel. And you experience it in a better setting with better lighting, better design than anything you could ever hope for, even if you're there. Now, the one difference is you can't stand there at the edge of the pit and experience the timelessness of that. But those are the kinds of things that, you know, we relish in. It's about people's experience that we can provide by having beautiful, authentic works, in this case, thousands of years old. You know, my favorite show, though, maybe kind of projecting into the future, will be in October when we do this exhibition of Hungarian American photographers. Yeah. I mean, one, because it's photography. Yeah. Two, because it's a story that's really not been told in a substantial way. A third thing is it's just going to be plain beautiful. Yep. I mean, absolutely beautiful photographs that, if for no other reason, people come and just get inspired by these great photographs that are taken in Hungary and in Germany and Paris and New York and Chicago and Hollywood and all in between. But for photographers and non-photographers alike, I mean, that'll be a kind of a pinnacle, an apex for me on the curatorial side, even though I know it's not going to attract large numbers of people, because people can't quite get their arms around, okay, so this is an exhibit of American photographers born in Hungary, you know, and
right.
Good cure for insomnia is what one could call it. You know, but I think that it'll be a beautiful exhibition. And it's going to tour. It's opening, as I mentioned, in Budapest. Yep. We'll come here and then finishes up at the George Eastman Museum, which for me is, you know, poetic. I've had three exhibitions that I've curated at the George Eastman Museum over the last 25 years. And so, I mean, it's the largest and best museum of photography in the world. So having it travel there has been hugely important. But, you know, we do it every day. You know, the Dawood Bey, you know, talking about photography, Dawood Bey captured the slave trail. We commissioned him to do the body work. I mean, it's almost ungodly how he has, with pure landscape photography, captured the soul and the spirit of the 350,000 people who walked along that trail, mostly in shackles, as enslaved people.
Yep.
And I run down there. I ran down there yesterday, as a matter of fact, and you know, it is the spirit of the place.
Yep.
And so that large and small shows from here and shows from China, they all kind of fit into the mix, because it's the culmination of all of those.
I always think it's really interesting, because I lived in Paris for 4 months. I was in that, you know, the Cité over there, and you know, I would just, Paris is so great just for walking around, and I would go to the Picasso museum all the time, like that in the Louvre, just because I could, because I had a pass, I could get in, and it's always cool to me to see artwork in a different place, I guess is the best way to say this. I remember seeing, there was a show, And I think it was at the Wexner Center? God, I can't remember if it was at the Wexner Center. But then I saw it down in Atlanta at, and I'm going to not remember the name of that museum down there. But it was like really cool to like see how different museums curate. And like, obviously, like that's part of what you've done and still do, and like curation. And I'm sure that plays into your head and in terms of your artwork too. Like, that's what I think it's so interesting, like, and fascinating to me is your, the complexity of your life and like these loves and how they, it's like a puzzle piece and how like different things like put your stuff together, I get, for lack of a better way to say it.
Well, you know, going back to the baseball team manager notion, I mean, I'm blessed with having assembled a great team of professionals. Yesterday, I was sitting down with our exhibit design people. There are six or seven of us in the room up in my office, spread out over a table. And Sarah Kennel, who's done an exhibition that will be at the same time as my Hungarian American in October. Hers is a history of photography in the South. It's down in Atlanta right now. I just finished in Atlanta at the High Museum.
That's what it was, the High. That's where that this show.
So, but we've got these great design people and lighting designers on staff. I mean, they make exhibitions look fabulous. And I will say that, you know, my exhibition on Hungarian American photography is going to be in Budapest at the National Gallery, which is a world-class museum, be at the George Eastman Museum here. But I guarantee you it'll look better here than anywhere else.
There you go. That's great. I love that. You know, one thing I always like to know, and I typically ask people, well, two these are kind of like wrapping it up because I know you're a busy person, so we got to move along. But I always like to know like influences or people that are inspiring to you. And then for you, like, you know, you've kind of answered this, but what are some, give me a 10-year plan of sorts. Like, what are you looking forward to in personally, professionally? But like, I always love to know, like for you, again, it could be like the, it could be Boog Powell is like an influence, you know, and then like, and then Ansel Adams, you know, it's like that to me is like really like, as I say, like I have influences from, you know, Dan Flavin to like Willie Mays to Chris Cornell as a singer. Like, and, and I'm being honest, like those are really people that inspire me. Like, so like for you, it's like, it could be like all over the place.
It is. Well, you know, in terms of photography, I think the photographers that have inspired me the most, Edward Weston would be at the top of the list by far. André Kertész would be pretty close up that way. But then a lot of photographers that, you know, are not household names that have always just fascinated me with their photography. You know, in terms of museum work, I just lost a really good friend, a guy by the name of Harry Parker, longtime director of Dallas, then moved to San Francisco. He'd been at the Met before that. And he was, I was a brand new art museum director in 1982. And the Association of Art of Museums assigned him as a seasoned museum director to be my mentor. And I learned from him, you know, how to be a good director, how to be calm, how to think big dreams and envision the future. And then also how important it is to connect the art museum to the audience. And he was one of the early people, this is back in the 70s and 80s, who firmly believed that art museums were for everybody and came from an education background at the Met. And that was important because, it, you know, in the day, and this is 40 some odd years ago, being a populist institution was not the tradition. You know, it's about museums are for the wealthy, the educated, and the few. And so Harry Parker was a great influence for that. But then, you know, I've had just countless colleagues that have likewise inspired me. And of course, you know, my inspiration in terms of the work ethic ends up being somebody like my father,
yeah.
who comes to this country with nothing, no English language skills, worked at a job that he hated for 33 years, 6 days a week, in a factory that didn't have heat in the winter and didn't have air conditioning in the summer, but did it because that's how he, you know, knew that he could provide for the family that he felt lucky to have, because he was essentially a homeless and countryless person before he landed in Rochester. And that man was an inspiration for me in that, you know, he ended up just being happy.
That's
and,
awesome.
And really at the very end of his life, he suffered from dementia and couldn't tell you who the president was, couldn't even tell you who I was, but he was happy. I mean, he would go around the hospital. He was in a memory ward for the last better part of the year, go around and pick up the hand of another patient and kiss her on the hand and say, "How are you today? And I hope you have a nice day." Uh-huh. And it's like, he wouldn't remember it 2 minutes later. But it's about what we all really seek, which is happiness.
Yep.
And, you know, maybe the last thing I'll say is that spending more time, we've got a $460 million capital campaign going on right now, a brand new wing, which is going to be another 170,000 square feet of building on the south and west side of the building. That's important for me to complete, cut the ribbon, and then spend a lot more time with family and a lot more time with my photography and writing and the things that I enjoy, because we're only on this planet for a certain period of time and we don't know what that is.
Yep.
I
am 100% right there with you. Like people ask me all the time how I'm doing and I'm awesome. Like I'm to this point where I am super happy. I'm busy, yeah. busy. But like for me, like going out west, I enjoy it. I love taking photographs. I love being in my studio. I love my friends, love my family. I love what I do. Like I feel like you said earlier about feeling lucky. Like I'm kind of the same way. Like this business, the Abstract Athlete, is it's like smashing my two loves together. Like I was hanging out with like former NFL players that are artists out there. That love what we're doing and they're like, you know, we've become like friends and it's, you know, I've never been a person that cares much about like stardom or anything like that, but it's like, when you realize you connect with somebody, it doesn't, and that they connect with you, like it's meaningful and it's rewarding. And I'm 100%, I think more people need to be happy or whatever that means to get to that point. Because I tell you, like it, you talk about the mental health stuff and it's like, man, I'm, and you can tell like you're a happy person too. It's just like, you can, you know?
Well, Ron, it's, you know, there's really a couple, three things, maybe four. One is, eat well,
yep.
Exercise and move around, socialize, you know, do what we're doing now, have engagement. I mean, I'm out all the time, 7 nights, 7 days a week. I mean, that's important, despite the fact that I can cloister myself in my studio here at home for 6 or 7 hours on a Sunday. It's like, it's fabulous. But I'll close with the last ingredient, which you've got nailed down. I've got nailed down. My wife, Catherine's got it nailed down because she paints every day. It's about being creative. And what being creative does to ensure our happiness. Now, hey, the source of frustration of working through an image on the screen for hours on end, making countless test prints, you know, 300 steps, 400 steps, and then the thing's a piece of junk and I have to move on. Yeah, it's frustrating. It never became what I dreamed it to become when I took the picture, but that's okay. Then I get a surprise that all of a sudden pops up. It's like, oh my God, all I was taking is a picture of shadows on a wall. And I thought it was so beautiful and so warm and captivating. And then only when I end up printing it out 24 by 36, do I realize, oh my God, I'm so glad I clicked the camera at that very second.
Yep.
But that creative piece is what I think more people miss than not.
Yep.
And mind you, my mother painted every day for the last 30 years of her life.
It's awesome.
Made her happy. And, you know, my father ended up matting all of her pictures, framing all of his pictures. And they had happiness together. But the creative piece is what I think I want to encourage more people to try, no matter what it is, writing, sculpture, you know, the chair of our board of trustees, Lynette Alston, has been coming to the studio school here in Richmond from 100 miles away. And she does it a couple of times a week doing ceramics.
Yep.
And she finds her peace and happiness with her hands in clay. And that's what we all should be doing. You do it. I do it. Only frustration is I don't do it enough because I've got this day job.
Yeah, me too. Damn it. No. And that's literally a lot about what we're doing. It's like, you know, working with professional athletes and veterans and stuff. They're a source of inspiration for other people because I always say, like, you remember Tony Mandrich, like he's a photographer and a really good photographer. And he's a 300-pound huge former offensive lineman. And he walks in the room, people look, oh, that's a pro athlete. But then when they see his photographs, I always say it gives people permission to be creative because I think a lot of people are not willing to be vulnerable in what creativity can be or like sharing that thing. And it's like, we don't have to share it, just do it. But like, it just gives people permission to do it. And I think that's, anyways, Alex, I know you got to go. And I just thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we're like, I want to grab coffee again and talk more because this is just the start. But, and one last thing, I always add new music to each episode and just write it on GarageBand. What kind of music do you like? Cause like,
oh my God.
Just some sort of, add something.
I hate to tell you, I'm probably stuck in the 60s
that's fine.
And 70s in any place, you know, everything from the Spinners and Elvis Presley to the Grassroots. Although I try to be, you know, something more timely. So I'm even listening to pop music, having watched the Super Bowl. Downloaded music by our new pop idol who, you know, entertained billions of people. And I have to say, it's enjoyable music. It's got a fun edge to it. So I'm all over. And then, I mean, hell, classical music. I grew up on classical music. So that, and then I listen to, I do most of my work in photography, listening to Benny Goodman.
Okay.
Artie Shaw, Bunny Berrigan, all these great band leaders. I've been listening to beautiful voices like Ella Fitzgerald.
Yep.
That gets me in the more quiet, wonderful place so I can actually have that in the background and be making great progress.
Awesome. Thank you, sir. This will be out in a couple weeks. I'll send some video and still stuff for you guys to share. I'll send it to both you and Candy. But thank you so much. This was awesome. So.
Hey,
talk
a
soon.
Pleasure, Ron.
Yep.
Great to talk to you.
Yep.
See you now. Bye. Bye.
You know, why I think that was such a great and important conversation is that it really emphasizes that we are all more than people think we are. You know, Alex is just a fantastic photographer. And what he has done for the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts is just incredible. But he also, you know, he loves sports. He had that dream of being a professional athlete. It's just so important to hear his story because I think it's inspirational. It also can just affect others. Really just incredible to hear his experiences. Again, make sure to follow Alex on Instagram at ALNYERGES and stop by his website, alexnerges.com. Remember to listen to the two other podcasts on the Abstract Athlete Network and stop by our website, theabstractathlete.com, and our social media platforms and check out our product lines, news, and upcoming events. Thank you for listening to the Abstract Athlete Podcast. We will see you next week. And as always, do not forget to exercise the body and do not forget to exercise the mind. Stay well out there.